ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 30th of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, a shocking rise in the number of women killed by their partners, fueling calls for urgent reform ahead of a national cabinet meeting. And grounded, Bonza Airlines cancels flights across the country as it considers the viability of its business.
I've just got here and some airport man out the front said, your flight's cancelled. I've come in and I can't find anyone to talk to. I haven't even received an email. Like, I've received nothing at all. Like, I don't get it.
Australia is making a bold bet on the future of quantum computing. The federal and Queensland governments are jointly investing almost $1 billion in a company which hopes to build the world's first commercially viable quantum computer. Some scientists say it could pave the way for many more innovations, such as the development of new medicines and the decarbonisation of the economy. Others question whether it's a gamble worth making. Gavin Coote reports.
The race to build a useful quantum computer is gathering pace around the world in the search for solutions to problems that standard computers cannot solve. The Federal Industry and Science Minister is Ed Husic.
Quantum computing is predicted to have profound impact because it'll unleash huge processing power that can be applied in a range of ways, from opening up discoveries in new medicines through to improving the way energy networks operate in the lead up to net zero.
In an effort to get ahead in this race, the federal and Queensland governments are each contributing $470 million to develop the world's first useful quantum computer. Stephen Bartlett is a professor of physics and director of the University of Sydney's Nano Institute. He points out while there are already quantum computers in use, they're still pretty small and extremely error-prone.
So you can run a simple demonstration and it shows that the principles of quantum computing work, but it's hard to use one of today's devices to actually solve an interesting problem, one that is inaccessible by today's supercomputers. And so when they say they want to build the first useful quantum computer, it's really thinking about a quantum computer at scale, able to solve those big, meaty problems.
What are the problems you'd like to solve or that you're most keen to see applied with a quantum computer?
Yeah, great question. My background's in physics, in quantum physics, and we actually think that most of the early applications of quantum computers will be in science, and that actually turns out also to be very useful. So there's fundamental quantum physics, quantum chemistry questions at the heart of drug design, at the heart of designing new batteries, designing new materials that you might use to make, for example, lightweight materials for aircraft. So those research questions actually are critically important for the world as we sort of continue our technological progress, but also as we go through a green energy transition.
The company that'll receive the government money and aim to build this quantum computer is Silicon Valley startup PsiQuantum. Its co-founder, Terry Rudolph, who grew up in Queensland, is hoping to have this system operating and solving some of these problems by the end of the decade.
We have the ability to make these small systems, but the final machine is a very big system. You've got to imagine it's like a sort of warehouse-sized, data center-sized machine with many of these things wired together. And so where we're transitioning to now is to building that kind of large piece of infrastructure, a bit like a data center.
Some in the scientific community are sceptical about the government's approach. University of Queensland adjunct research fellow Tim Deignan sees it as a big gamble that may not pay off for a long time, if at all.
You never know. There could be a series of amazing breakthroughs and they could manage to use a quantum computer to do these things in the short term. But it's a very risky bet and it would be much more sensible, in my opinion, to back a diversity of different approaches. And just like an investment portfolio where you don't put all of your money into one company, you fund a range of different companies in the hopes that one of those investments will pay off.
Others see it as a worthwhile investment and one that will fit in with a broader plan to grow the nation's quantum industry. Professor Ben Buchler is an expert in quantum optics with Australian National University.
It's really great. You know, so the people who develop some of these technologies were doing it overseas, but they originally were trained and came from Australia, and they're sort of coming back. And I think that's good for the community, and hopefully good for the long-term economic benefit of the country when we're looking at doing things other than digging holes in the ground. We're looking sort of forward and looking at sort of new technology spaces that we have a strength in that we can use to develop new economy.
That's Professor Ben Buchler from the Australian National University, ending that report by Gavin Coote. The latest homicide statistics paint an alarming picture for Australia's First Nations women. The rate of Indigenous women killed by a current or former partner is more than six times the rest of the population. In remote communities, anti-violence advocates say much more needs to be done to support women trying to escape harm. Angus Randall reports.
Every wet season, the roads are closed around the remote Indigenous town of Kalumburu in far northwestern Australia. It makes it incredibly difficult for women to escape domestic violence. Colleen Zulian is the senior coordinator at the Kalumburu Women's Refuge. She says flying women out of town is often not enough.
That is very temporary because the man will, once those roads are open, or they will get on a plane and go and bring them back.
The town has a population of around 400 people. More than 90% of residents are Indigenous, and anyone trying to escape domestic violence risks leaving their entire life behind.
It's very, very difficult for them to relocate and have a new start. These are women that have been grown up here in a small community. So they're frightened of the cities. Even if we did relocate them, say, to Perth or to Melbourne, they don't know anybody, they've got no money, so it's very, very hard for them to relocate.
The latest homicide statistics released by the Australian Institute of Criminology reveal a rise in the number of women murdered by a partner or former partner in the 12 months to June 2023. There were 34 deaths, an increase from 26 the previous year. It comes as a shock to report author Dr. Samantha Bricknell.
It wasn't actually an increase that we were expecting to see, because since 1989-90 we've had largely a decrease in intimate partner homicide that's perpetrated against a female. Overall, we've had a 66% decrease in intimate partner homicide rates.
For First Nations women, the rate of deaths last year was more than six times the rest of the population.
In 22-23, the rate was about 3.07 per 100,000 for First Nations women and girls, compared to 0.45 for non-Indigenous women and girls. And we do see, across the 30-odd years of this homicide monitoring program, that homicide victimisation rates for First Nations women and girls is anywhere between 2 to 8 times that of non-Indigenous women and girls. So that is a consistent finding.
Speaking from Alice Springs, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he's investing millions of dollars into violence prevention.
So we are providing additional funding for services. It's a part of the $250 million program that we have.
Back in Kalumburu, Colleen Zulian says there needs to be greater education in schools, and men who break the law need to face tougher penalties.
A lot of the girls won't press charges because of the repercussions. It's that feeling of nothing's going to happen if we do. So, you know, and a fine is not enough. A warning is not enough. When these boys, especially when they're young, when they're in their 20s and that, you know, nothing happens until they do something really serious. And it's too late then.
Associate Professor Hannah McGlade is a Kuren Menang woman at Curtin University. She says governments have often failed to take domestic violence against First Nations women seriously.
Men and male perpetrators are often able to play the system. We're not really valuing the lives, the safety of Indigenous women who are dying at such shocking rates. The legal system and governments really have not been serious enough to date, have certainly failed, and we need to do much better.
Tomorrow, National Cabinet will hear from Domestic, Sexual and Family Violence Commissioner Michaela Cronin, who will call for a roadmap to protect women from domestic violence. A national register for offenders, electronic monitoring and national coordination of intelligence on serial violent offenders could be on the agenda.
Angus Randall, and if this story has caused you any distress, you can call the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Crisis Support Line 13 YARN. That's 139276. Well, on the agenda at National Cabinet is a discussion about the policy framework that's needed to tackle the complex problem of male violence and what funding is needed to turn the shocking statistics around. Anti-domestic violence advocates say critical prevention work is also needed in schools, clubs and grassroots community organisations. So what can the Australian community do to get better at recognising the signs of coercive control and violence within families? Kirsty Sherpig is the director of the education and intervention program Mate Bystander. She joined me earlier.
A bystander is anyone. We're all bystanders, so we don't actually have to be there or see it in the moment to be a bystander. If we hear or see something, we are still a bystander. We still have a responsibility to do something. Our program teaches people to be an active bystander and what they can do in the moment and what they can do after the moment to support people and provide support for the person receiving the problematic behaviour and those using the problematic behaviour.
Where do you see this kind of action fitting into the whole approach to the problem? I've heard in the past few days people saying raising awareness and talking about the problem just isn't enough. It isn't doing enough.
We need education. We need people to understand what it is that domestic and family violence looks like. We've had some people come to us in the past say, oh, I've never experienced domestic violence. That doesn't happen. And so what our training does is really unpacks what it looks like in real life. So it's more than just violence. We're not looking for the bruises, but we're looking for things like financial abuse and using isolation, all the other parts of domestic violence that aren't as obvious to people in your workplace or people in the community.
What questions do you think people should ask of women? What does support look like?
The main thing we can do is believe women. It doesn't cost us anything, but we must believe them and be non-judgmental. The other thing that we like to say is there has to be no conditions or an expiry. So if someone says, look, I'm really struggling, you know, this is happening in my relationship, whatever that woman is going through at that time, it's up to her how she deals with that. She needs to be the one that says, I'm ready to go now, or I need this from you now, or I need help with the safety plan. So you need to be really guided by them and definitely just stay in there, hang in there, check in with them and ask questions like, are you okay? I'm wondering how you're coping lately. I've noticed some changes lately and I'm wondering if everything's okay for you, because you never know when they're going to say, yep, okay, I'm ready, I need some help.
What prevents people from doing something?
There's a lot of different reasons. I mean, we know with the research that the most common reason for not doing something is called pluralistic ignorance. So it's basically a situation in which the majority of group members privately reject a norm but go along with it because they're worried that they might get it wrong. So they incorrectly assume that everyone else accepts that behaviour, and that's not true. The second thing is fear, and fear is very, very real. Worrying about that they don't have all the information or that they might make things worse. But at the end of the day, if you're seeing this behaviour, it's already worse. If you're hearing these things, it's already bad. And by not doing something, what message are we sending to that victim? No one's going to support you. You're on your own. That's fine. We accept it. And what message are we sending to that person that's using violence? We're saying it's okay and that's not okay. And if you get it wrong, what have you lost? You know, you've tried, you've said the right thing, and if you've got it wrong, you can say, oh, sorry, my mistake, no worries.
What about the role of alcohol and pornography? We've heard again in the past couple of days from researchers who say there's very clear lines between the use of alcohol and pornography and domestic violence incidents. Is it the role of bystanders to intervene on those issues?
We need men to speak up. We need men to speak to their mates. We need them to have those conversations. Things like rigid gender stereotypes and sexist language and jokes and the objectification of women and victim blaming and pornography and all of that. And if we're not calling our mates on that along the continuum, then that's how the culture of violence is created.
That's Kirsty Sherpig from the Education and Intervention Program, Mate Bystander. And if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. If it's an emergency, of course, call 000. This is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Embattled budget airline Bonza appears to be in trouble. Some passengers have been left stranded after the carrier cancelled all flights today while it discusses its future. Aviation sector experts say the company was doomed from the start, sparking the question, is there room for a new airline to break into the Australian market? Kathleen Ferguson has this report.
There was a lot of fanfare for Australia's newest budget airline ahead of its maiden flight last January.
It's a historic day for aviation in Queensland, with Bonza's first flight taking off from its home base on the Sunshine Coast.
Bonza flight AB777 to Whitsunday Post Airport and is now ready for boarding through gate number 7. Woo!
Bonza promised more flights and cheaper tickets in underserved regions. It was the first new local airline that launched since Tiger 15 years ago. But today they have cancelled all their services, affecting potentially thousands of passengers. It's left people like Nicole Morris frustrated and confused as she tries to get home to Rockhampton from Melbourne.
We want to go home, and I've just got here and some airport man out the front said, your flight's cancelled. I've come in and I can't find anyone to talk to. There's nobody here.
She says she hasn't heard from Bonza.
I haven't even received an email or nothing to say my flight's cancelled.
When the Sunshine Coast-based airline was first announced, its chief executive, Tim Jordan, said the carrier was different from other options.
So we're about the teachers, the tradies, the kids and the carers. We're about getting people home to see their families. We're about getting people home from university to university, getting away for a 3-day break, 4-day break.
But it's that difference that some experts believe isn't sustainable in Australia. Keith Tonkin is an aviation analyst.
The model for the airline was to service routes that weren't serviced by those other mainline operators of Virgin and Qantas and more recently Rex. And there was some discussion during that process that they might find it difficult to make a profit on those routes simply because they had relatively thin margins.
Bonza CEO Tim Jordan released a statement this morning saying services were being temporarily suspended. He said discussions were underway over the ongoing viability of the business. He also apologised to customers, saying Bonza was trying to find a way to keep flying. The airline last month denied reports it was in trouble financially. But international aviation consultant Neil Hansford says there are problems.
I didn't see them lasting until till Christmas, and I think they've gone on past Christmas. But the situation they've got is that their owners, their financiers, 777 partners, have got their own problems in the United States.
But there are still a lot of questions about what's happening behind the scenes and whether the airline will continue to fly in Australia. Aviation analyst Keith Tonkin again.
That's difficult to know at the moment because we don't really have a good insight into the situation for them financially, although they have been having difficulties in sourcing and paying for aircraft.
But the biggest question for customers is what to do now. Qantas and Jetstar have offered free flights for stranded Bonza customers on some cancelled routes where they have overlap and if those flights have any spare seats.
Kathleen Ferguson. Scotland's First Minister Hamza Youssef has resigned to avoid a confidence vote he was expected to lose. The head of the pro-independent Scottish National Party said it was an honour to lead Scotland, which he did for little over a year. Michelle Rimmer has this report from London.
When Hamza Youssef took over as Scotland's First Minister in March last year, he made history. The son of Pakistani immigrants, he became the first Muslim head of government in modern Western Europe. But while his predecessor Nicola Sturgeon served in the role for 10 years, Hamza Youssef's time as First Minister was short-lived. After just 13 months in the top job, the 39-year-old has announced his resignation.
I have informed the SNP's National Secretary of my intention to stand down as party leader and ask that she commences a leadership contest for my replacement as soon as possible. I cannot tell you what an honour it is being the First Minister of the country I love, the country I'm raising my family in, and the only country I will ever call home.
Mr. Youssef was facing a vote of no confidence this week that he was expected to lose. It's after he controversially ended a power-sharing deal between his Scottish National Party and the Greens. The coalition broke down after the Scottish leader walked back from a key climate target.
I clearly underestimated the level of hurt and upset that caused Green colleagues. for a minority government to be able to govern effectively and efficiently, trust when working with the opposition is clearly fundamental. I've concluded that repairing our relationship across the political divide can only be done with someone else at the helm.
The Scottish National Party is now facing its second leadership crisis in just over a year. It puts the party and the Scottish independence movement it stands for in a precarious position, with a UK general election expected before the end of the year. Polls show support for the SNP in Scotland has dipped below Labour for the first time in a decade. Political scientist Sir John Curtis says the SNP's next move could prove crucial.
Labour are, of course, hoping to profit substantially from SNP electoral troubles, and it looks as though those troubles may now have got worse. That said, Labour need to bear in mind that the SNP now have a chance to choose a new leader who might unite the party and prove to be more popular in a way that Mr. Yusuf was not.
The SNP has 28 days to decide who that new leader will be.
Michelle Rimmer. Well, we've all heard the stories about the one that got away, but a 19-year-old from Katherine in the Northern Territory has a great yarn to tell after catching a barramundi that has won him $1 million. Keegan Payne snagged the prize fish, which has eluded anglers since the competition was first established 9 years ago. Nick Grimm reports.
For 19-year-old Keegan Payne, tossing a line into the Katherine River has been a life-changing experience.
Oh, it felt good. We weren't actually expecting a tag barra at the time until her little sister actually asked what it was in the fish, and we told her, and we were freaking out. We nearly crashed the boat getting back to the boat ramp, but it was good.
He's the first angler ever to catch the Northern Territory's most elusive fish, released each year into the Top Ends waterways as part of an annual competition set up to lure recreational fishers, hoping they can be the one to score a $1 million haul. But for the past nine seasons, no one has been able to find, let alone reel in, the fish bearing the winning tag. NT Chief Minister Eva Lawler announced this year's lucky recipient this morning.
After nine seasons, the barra has been caught. But $1 million today goes to Keegan Payne. Keegan from Katherine. He caught the fish in the, well, it's maybe a bit of a secret spot, but he can tell you about that. But he's caught the $1 million barra.
Oh, the whole family was shocked. They're all proud of me.
Keegan Payne says the prize money he'll receive will mean a lot for himself and his seven siblings. He says Katherine will keep on being home, but he's contemplating splashing out on a trip to America, along with a new car and, of course, a new boat.
We're from Katherine, only a small town. Mum's from Kakadu, and and Dad's from Queensland. We've been growing up in Katherine for, I think, 28 years now. It's pretty hard going for us at the moment with money, but, now with $1 million, don't have to complain about it.
Meanwhile, disappointed fishers still have a bit of time left to potentially hook other tag barramundis worth $10,000. And next year, there will be another $1 million fish released into the Territory's waters. Ronald Vukalos is manager of Darwin's Fishing and Outdoor World.
It's been a struggle to find red tags this year. It's been one of the trickiest years, and that's actually not a bad thing because we've had a couple of consecutive good wet seasons, so we've got a really healthy barra population. So obviously 100 tagged fish plus a few extras, you know, trying to pluck them out of millions and millions of barramundi is no easy feat. So an area like that part of the Katherine River isn't, like, you don't get lots and lots of barra there. So that's, if it was going to come from somewhere, it would have been one of those areas where there's not as big a population of barramundi as, say, further down the tidal section of the Daly River or something like that.
And I guess you'd have to say every fisher person has got a good story to tell, but young Keegan Payne has probably got the best story of all today.
Yeah, I don't know of too many, fishing trips where someone, normally we say about the thousands that it costs you to in the endless pursuit of that iconic fish, particularly barramundi. So not many people end up with a $1 million bonus just for going and participating in the greatest activity one can do, particularly up here in the Northern Territory.
Ronald Vukalos from Darwin's Fishing and Outdoor World, ending that report by Nick Grimm. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. At big rallies on the weekend, women and men came together to say enough is enough. Violence against women must end. But how do we end it? Today, host of Radio National Breakfast and the Party Room podcast, Patricia Karvelis, on what really needs to happen to fix one of the nation's most entrenched problems. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.